Hi, this is Brandy Wilson
and Jessica Smith,
and this is Facts Matter. This is our second podcast, so thanks for joining us. We're really excited about it.
Mm-hmm. And last month's episode was Harm Reduction 101. In that episode, we focused on the principles of harm reduction, which guide our work, and we really encourage all of you to check out that episode if you haven't yet. It's going to be really helpful, especially if you're still a little uncertain about what exactly harm reduction is and why it is that it guides the work that we do.
This episode, we're going to talk about overdose prevention and education, and that's a really big topic. So it's actually going to be two parts. It's going to be this month and next month. This month, we're going to cover opiate-related overdose information and education, and then next month we will focus on part two, will be stimulant overdose education and prevention.
In this episode of Hashtag Facts Matter, we will be discussing overdose prevention, what exactly that is, and how we implement it. We're also going to discuss what naloxone is and a little bit of history around that as well, and all the tools that people can use to help their friends and loved ones stay alive.
Well, that sounds like an interesting episode, Jessica.
I think so.
So, this week in harm reduction, we lost a harm reduction giant, and that was Dan Bigg. He is the patron saint of harm reduction, and he was one of the people who started Chicago Points Recovery. And so a lot of this work is because of him, and this episode is definitely dedicated to him. And in 1996, Dan passed out the first vial of naloxone, and our movement really began. Dan is responsible for making sure that over 100 programs in the U.S. have access to naloxone. For our program alone, he gave us our first 200 vials at a Drug Policy Alliance conference in Washington, D.C., and that really put us in overdrive to start our program. And so just with our program alone, you know, he started the thing that led us to naloxone and overdose prevention, and we've had over 400 reversals since that time he gave us those first ones, and a lot of that can really be accredited to him. So this podcast is in memory of his work. And August 31st, we host International Overdose Awareness Day. And so for all the local people, that is on the waterfront at Seiko Amphitheater. And it's from 12 to 5. Speakers begin at 1. We'll have a memorial space and music and food. And like I said, speakers, as well as naloxone training and distribution and tabling by different community partners, and then Department of Health and Human Services is going to be providing HIV and Hep C testing. So all of those things are related to overdose prevention, and sending lots of love out to our harm reduction family.
And if you are local in Humboldt County, please feel free to join us at our event. It is for everybody. We are going to be not only celebrating the lives of those that we've lost, but also celebrating and validating those who are still with us and who may be going through their own struggles. So in this next segment, we are going to talk a little bit about the signs of an opiate overdose, what to look for, and who exactly is at risk. So first, what is an opiate overdose? An opiate overdose occurs when someone has taken too much of an opiate-based substance. This could be things like Norcos, Oxy, heroin, Vicodin, fentanyl, or anything else in the opiate family. We've been seeing a lot of issues with fentanyl unknowingly being in substances, meth and heroin, across the nation. People have been overdosing and dying because of it, so it's really important to be able to look for that in other drugs if you're not suspecting it. opiate overdoses can also happen if opiates are taken in combination with another drug, and also with alcohol. So alcohol is a huge factor in increasing the risk of opiate overdose. Things like benzodiazepine, Valium, Ativan, that also can add to the risk of having an overdose. So what should you look for if you think someone is having an opiate overdose? What exactly, you know, what does that look like? How are you going to know? So you want to see and ask yourself, are they turning blue? Do they have blue lips and nails? Are they breathing shallow, or do they have no breath at all? Can you feel a pulse, no pulse, slow heart rate? Do their eyes, their pupils, are they small, pinpoint sized? Is there any sort of gurgling or choking noises? Those are all going to be indicative of someone having an opiate overdose.
And so who's at risk, possibly, of overdose? A lot of times we have this idea that it's, you know, people who use substances that we see who might be homeless. But in fact, here in Humboldt County, our biggest amount of overdoses are housed people. And so that stigma doesn't necessarily hold true to fact. So who is at risk? People who take high doses of opiates for pain management, a lot of times those are the folks that may not be as educated about what overdose is or how drugs interact with each other. And so lack of information is really what one of the things that put people at risk. People who have had a period of abstinence and then use again, such as people being released from jail, prison, or detox. And Jessica will talk a little later in the show about some research around
overdose, the prevalence of overdose in people who are recently released from prison or jail. Yeah, we can.
Should we talk about that now? Let's talk about that now.
We can talk about that right now. So there's been quite a bit of research done on this issue. So if someone goes away and they're in prison and jail, they may not have access to the drugs that they were using before. So if they come out and then use the amount that maybe they were used to using, they can likely die. But so what the research has found is that there really is an increased risk for people to overdose in the first 2 weeks after being released. It also shows that people who died within 2 months after being released were generally, on average, incarcerated longer than those who lived past the two-month mark. So if you're, the longer you're in jail, the more likely it's going to be that you might be susceptible to an overdose. There's a very large cohort study done in Washington State on prisoners that had been released between 1999 and 2003. They found that 103 inmates died of an overdose, and 27 of those died within the first 2 weeks. So it's 25% of the number of folks that were studied, 25% of inmates that are being released are gonna die from an overdose. And also 27 of those inmates who overdosed did so because they were using multiple substances. So polysubstance use is a huge issue, specifically for us here in Humboldt County. But as we stated before, generally it's really not a great idea to mix substances, because it's going to increase your likelihood of overdosing. So the study also found that recently released inmates were 12.7 times more likely to die within the first 2 weeks of release than any other resident in the area. And in the United Kingdom, a really cool preliminary study took place starting in 2012. It was called NALIVE, the Naloxone Investigation Randomized Trial. It was meant to see if releasing prisoners with naloxone could decrease overdose rates. The trial didn't get past preliminary stage because the researchers were actually finding that those prisoners were more likely to save the lives of their friends than of themselves, and the researchers really meant to determine, they wanted to try to determine whether those involved in the trial were decreasing their risk of overdose. So I think it's awesome that these released inmates were saving other people's lives, but for the sake of the research and of that trial specifically, they wanted to see if it was directly affecting the people involved. They did find that from data from Scotland that there was a decrease in drug-related deaths within 4 weeks of release if prisoners were given naloxone. So it really, you know, it's this research is being done in the UK and here. It's pretty vast, and it really just shows the importance of having folks be educated and have naloxone on hand, especially if they're coming from a situation where maybe they were abstinence for a while and just are at higher risk of having an overdose.
Thanks for sharing that. So the rest of the who's at risk for an overdose list, you know, we have people taking high doses for pain. We have people who have had period of abstinence and then use again, as Jessica just described, some of the research around that. Also people who mix substances. She touched on that a little bit as well. Alcohol, really, when you throw that in the mix, it really amps up the possibility of potential overdose, as well as benzos. So being educated around that and being smart about those decisions is really important, as well as people who have previously overdosed. So those are the folks, you know, a short list of folks who are at overdose risk. So in this episode, we have mentioned a lot about stigma numerous times. You know, stigma kills people, stigma this, stigma that. So for the next few minutes, we're really going to talk about what we mean and how stigma actually kills. There's a lot of different ways that that can happen. One way that we even think about drug use, and that is when we say someone is clean or dirty. I showered today, and so whether or not I put drugs in my body doesn't mean I'm going to be dirty. That's some old rhetoric from things that have been around for a long time. But what that means is, you know, if someone has a drink, does that make them a dirty person? I don't think so. So even just to begin, if we can start with, you know, a person who uses drugs, not an addict. Or, you know, none of us are defined by one single term. We always are people first. And so when we talk about drug use, you know, someone currently might be an active drug use, or someone might not be using drugs, but clean or dirty is something that we do with laundry and dishes. It's not about drug use.
Yeah. You know, Brandy also mentioned something about, oh, if you have a drink, does that make you dirty? We think a lot about drugs and substances, substance use in general, kind of on a hierarchy of, you know, what's appropriate and what's not, what's socially acceptable and what's not. So oftentimes people who maybe have a drinking problem, they aren't really going to be seen by society as the low of the low. They might not be judged as harshly as, say, someone who is using needles and maybe using heroin. And they're going to get, you know, labeled with horrible names and just really torn down as being seen as useless and unproductive. And I've had family members who had really bad drinking problems, and they were not functional, and everyone had sympathy for them and wanted them to get better, but they didn't treat them, you know, the way that maybe they would treat someone who was using something different, like meth or heroin. So we have to be really careful to understand and acknowledge that
any kind of substance you use can be harmful if you're not using it responsibly. Alcohol has a lot of social harms. People get into their cars and they drive when they're wasted and they can kill people. So for us to say, you know, oh, well, they're just having a couple of glasses, and then really just shame people who are doing something else, it creates its stigma, and it's really harmful to everybody involved, because then those people who maybe have that drinking issue aren't being held accountable the same way as maybe we're trying to hold other people accountable.
The way that stigma kills people is that, so, you know, we accept alcohol as a social norm, but we don't accept the illicit drugs. And the only reason they're illicit is because of policy, mm-hmm. not because they cause more harm. The harm comes from the bad policy that makes people hide and makes people ashamed. And so those people then are now separated from community, from support, from really many things, even getting services. So many times people come in here and they walk in just carrying so much shame, that how do you get out of that to be able to feel connected enough to want to engage with people and be honest? Because if you're using an illicit drug, society has created these situations where you always have to lie about your drug use, where you always feel shame about your drug use. And that's why people use behind closed doors. That's why people use alone, and that's where they die. When I started Hatcher, New Year's morning of 2012, that's not when I started it, but this is one of the key pieces. New Year's morning of 2012, someone I was close to overdosed and died, and that person wasn't a regular heroin user. Everyone had been hanging out on New Year's, but he wanted to do some heroin. And so because there is that stigma, he went home and used in a house by himself. And then a day later, someone found him dead. So it's those sorts of things. You know, there was a group of friends and he didn't even feel comfortable around everyone that was drinking, which has been proven to be more harmful. So he had to go do his drug of choice for that night by himself. And so he's no longer with us. And it's that stigma and it's that separation that kills people. You know, and it keeps people from engaging in things like Suboxone. There's even a lot of stigma around Suboxone. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many people who don't think that they can do, you know, that they are seen as quote unquote clean if they're on Suboxone. Well, that's some old rhetoric that is just stigma based. There's no evidence around why anyone would think you're quote on, you know, you're not doing a proper program if you're on Suboxone. The goal is any positive change. And Dan Big, actually, his thing was celebrate any positive change.
We see this stigma happen a lot with our consumers, especially with their medical care. They'll come in and, you know, they'll say, well, I don't want my doctor to know that I'm using. I'm afraid that, you know, they won't give me the same kind of care, or they won't, you know, help me get into this surgery or this program. And sometimes, unfortunately, that's real. Like, I have heard conversations that consumers have with their medical professional, and the tone that those people use is very different than if I make a phone call and try to get an appointment and try to set things up. It's just they're treated as less than, and so why, if you're treated that way, anytime you try to help yourself, anytime you try to be safe and healthy, and everyone just kind of treats you like you don't deserve that, why would you ever go back to try to get that help? Why would you try, you know, to get what you need and to get into services if everyone is going to treat you like you don't actually deserve it?
What one of the things that really the stigma for people who use drugs when they go to the emergency room.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the biggest. We've seen people die from abscesses because they've gone to the emergency room and the emergency room just tells them they're drug seeking and turns them away. Mm-hmm. Last year, actually, there were 3 people, like, back to back within, all within 2 weeks, that all died of abscess-related issues because they were turned away at the emergency room or they had tried numerous times and it didn't work. And so people are only going to hit their head against a wall so many times before you just say, screw it. They don't want to help me. Fine. I don't want help. And that's where people die. And I value life. I value the life of even people who don't value other people's lives. And we all live here and we're all a community. And we need to make sure that those spaces where people can reach out and make connections, that those spaces, like here, are free of stigma. That's real, you know, stigma kills.
Plain and simple. I do want to say just a quick thing that's kind of related to all of this. We get a lot of backlash about normalizing drug use. We're normalizing treating people like people. That's really what we're trying to normalize. We have to meet folks where they're at, and if they are afraid to be honest with us and to share what's going on in their lives, and if they're afraid to do that with the people that they're closest to, and their doctors and all of this, like, that's what's going to put them in more danger than just their drug use alone. So, you know, we understand people are going to use drugs. People are going to drink. People are going to have unsafe sex. People are going to do all of these things that could possibly cause them harm. I'm going to keep playing roller derby and I might break something.
I go out in the sun without sunscreen sometimes.
So we all do the things that maybe we're like, eh, this isn't the best thing for us for one reason or another. But we're still going to do it. So I just really think this idea of normalizing drug use, it's just kind of a false thing. And we really are trying to normalize people-to-people contact, understanding what someone is going through, humanizing folks, you know, meeting them where they're at and saying, how can we help you? How can we make life better for you? How can we help you help yourself?
And considering that most everyone uses some kind of drugs.
Caffeine.
It kind of is normal that people use drugs. It's the policy that makes certain things abnormal. It's the policy. I hate bad policy. That's policy causes most of our problems. Okay, so we've talked about what an overdose is, signs to look for, and who's at risk. And now we're going to talk about what to do if someone is overdosing. So if those signs are present and the person uses opiates, then call 911. And in California, we have a Good Samaritan law. And throughout the country, I also believe that it exists. And that states that if 911 is called in the event of an overdose, the unconscious person nor anyone at the scene will be charged with possession or under the influence, with possession of paraphernalia or under the influence, or be charged with any personal amounts of substances. This was done in an effort to make sure that people would call 911. Back before this was a thing, people would do really interesting things to try and revive someone. You know, I've heard stories of ice being put in body cavities, and, you know, I heard one pretty rough story about a woman who overdosed, and they didn't have naloxone, and so they put her in a bike carriage and drove around town hoping that the cold air and movement would bring her back. And it did not. So that's why we're grateful for naloxone, and that's why we're grateful for the Good Samaritan law. And it's critical that people feel secure in being able to call that. So adhering to that law is really important in saving people's lives. So call 911 and then try waking people up by yelling their name or using your knuckles really hard, rubbing it on their sternum. That sometimes will get someone who's just really in a deep nod to wake up. Check their breathing or their pulse, and then administer naloxone if they didn't wake up from the knuckle rub. And so depending on what kind you have, you might need to get the shot ready. If it's an intramuscular shot, there's some things you'll have to do. And so make sure you give them rescue breaths and continue to take breaths for yourself after, and continue that for 3 minutes. Being mindful of if they have vomited, then, you know, you'll need to turn them on their side and clean that up. And then, but somehow make sure that the air is getting into them. And continue that pattern for 3 minutes. And if the person still hasn't woken up and EMS isn't there, give them the second shot. And continue doing that for every 3 minutes. If they haven't woken up, give them the shot until EMS gets there. And then some critical reminders about that is after the person wakes up, if they didn't go with the ambulance, don't leave them again for at least 4 hours. Another overdose can return if the naloxone wears off, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. An overdose can happen again. So don't leave them alone and don't let them use for a while.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about what exactly naloxone is and who should carry it. So naloxone is an opiate antagonist. What that pretty much means is that it can create a barrier in our opiate receptors, which help our brain to start its automatic breathing response. So when someone's having slow to no breathing, that's where the problem overdose comes in. As Brandy stated, naloxone can last for about 20 to 90 minutes. When someone gets hit with that dose of naloxone, they're gonna sober up pretty quick. So they might not be the happiest, but again, as Brandy stated, please stay with the person, make sure they don't use again, because the opiates are still gonna be in their system even if they're not feeling it anymore. So naloxone has no abuse potential and people cannot get high with it. So it is in fact going to do the opposite of get you high. You are not going to be high anymore. And naloxone really is, it's used worldwide to save lives. And in fact, people who use drugs, they make the biggest impact when it comes to saving people's lives with naloxone. Because these folks are more likely to be present when an overdose event occurs. So it's really, really important that people who use drugs are supported in doing this life-saving work, that they are provided the resources and the education and the actual naloxone to keep their friends alive. It's also really important that family members and friends of people who use drugs, whether those are illicit street drugs or illicit, you know, prescribed painkiller opiates, it's really important that those folks also carry naloxone. Like we said, specifically here in Humboldt County, prescription opiates are responsible for a large number of our overdoses. So you might think that someone who is houseless and injecting drugs on the street is at more of a risk, but it could just be that someone who is in, you know, pain management using opiates at home is going to be more likely to have an overdose because maybe they just don't expect it. They think that because they're being prescribed this thing, there's not as much risk, they're safer, but it's just not the case. And if you're not prepared with the proper tools and education, then you just might suffer from an overdose. Also, naloxone is the drug that reverses overdoses. It comes in different, you can administer it in different ways. So people will often use naloxone and Narcan interchangeably. Narcan is actually a specific brand, and it's specific to a nasal spray. So that's one route. Narcan, you can distribute it as a nasal spray. Naloxone can be injected using a vial and a syringe, and like Brandy said, intramuscularly. And then there's also I believe it's a shot as well, but it's kind of like an automated thing. So it'll talk to you, so you don't actually have to draw up the fluid, you know, from the vial into the syringe, but it's just kind of like this black box, and it gives you verbal description of what to do.
Those are really hard to come by because the company charges thousands of dollars per dose now. Yeah. Is that my turn? Yes. So this is a huge topic, and we absolutely have not discussed it thoroughly here, and there's a few really important things. So if you do use opiates, there's some guidelines. I know people don't really like rules, but these are some rules to stay alive, and that is never use alone and do not use behind locked doors. Make sure someone around you carries naloxone, and make sure you have a plan. It's always important to have a using plan with your friends and family, and that discusses, you know, your wants and your needs around overdose prevention. And it also makes it so that they're aware that you aren't claiming. It just makes it important so that everyone knows. So like I said, this is a huge topic and we could go on forever, but we have really run out of time for today's episode. So next month we will discuss part two of overdose prevention, and that's around stimulant use and education. But what I really want to encourage you is we're going to have a number of links, connected to this podcast, and they will, some of them will be the articles that Jessica discussed, but some of them will also be links to information related to overdose prevention. We're also going to include our overdose prevention training. So one of the things we do when we do naloxone training, and that will also help people sort of understand and visualize what it is we're talking about. And we'll also talk about the work that we do here at Hatcher to prevent the loss of life around overdose, and the ways that we implement a lot of, you know, what we've been taught.
Mm-hmm. And in the following months after this part two, we will also be looking into other ways to prevent overdoses. This includes stuff like medicated assisted treatment, or MET, different education, and also cannabis as a way to decrease opiate use. So we will also be having experts on this topic join us so that they can share their knowledge. But for right now, this is all we have time for.
We do have one great addition to our podcast that we want to share with you, and that is hashtag Facts Matter is in part funded by the Syringe Access Fund, a collaborative of AIDS United, Elton John AIDS Foundation, the H. Van Amerigen Foundation, the Levi Strauss Foundation, and the Open Society Foundations.
So we just like to give a big thank you to these folks for their generous funding. And we really hope that you join us next month for part two on stimulant overdoses and the work that we do here at Hatcher to provide overdose prevention, and training, and prevent overdose deaths. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.